Here we are in October, and suddenly 2018 doesn't seem far away at all. So let's think about money questions. Perhaps one has been percolating in the back of your mind. It's Tuesday, October 3rd, and it's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This hour, anything goes on your money. Perhaps it's a question that can help you start 2018 in a better financial situation. Kevin McKinley is here to help. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Good morning, Kevin.
Hello. Kate, right? Hello, Kate.
I'll get it right. The tradition continues. Thank you, Kevin. Well, it's a special thank you edition of On Your Money, and we're devoting the entire show to answering your personal finance questions.
Yes, during last week's membership drive, we had three separate shows, and during those shows, we asked for your support of On Your Money in Wisconsin Public Radio, but we also framed it as a celebration of Joy Cardine's career. Perhaps you've heard, Kate, but she retired, and anyone who pledged any dollar amount during those three broadcasts received a copy of the On Your Money mini money booklet, Retire Early and Forever.
And once again, your On Your Money listeners responded in full force.
How they do it, I do not know, but I'm eternally grateful for their generosity. During Saturday's live show, Tuesday's live show, and then Saturday's rebroadcast, 1,431 people pledged, including over 800 on last Tuesday's show. And raised a total of almost $88,000 during those three shows. That means that On Your Money listeners so far this year have donated over $140,000 to Wisconsin Public Radio. And best of all, 100% of that money, Kate, goes directly to Wisconsin Public Radio. So thank you very much for all that you've done during the year. And hopefully that support will continue.
And we're doing more than just saying thank you.
That is correct. We are devoting the entire hour to answering your questions. You can call during this hour at 800-642-1234. Send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or send one to me directly, kevin@onyourmoney.com, and we'll try to get to all the questions we can.
Let's start with a question from Beth, who says, I will be 66 next February. I plan to work full-time for 2.5 more years. However, she says, I would like to start collecting Social Security at 66. I do not think that the growth in my Social Security account will be affected very much by not waiting until I actually retire. The person I spoke to at the Social Security office said that the growth in my monthly amount would not be that great by waiting to apply. My husband, though, thinks it's a bad idea. So, Kevin, what do you think? Are you there, Kevin?
Yeah, I have been here and am still
okay.
Here.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, the On Your Money rule on spousal financial disputes is whoever asks the question during the show here is right. We side with them no matter what the actual answer is.
But does that hold true here?
It depends on your definition of that much. If you wait 1 year to take Social Security after you've reached full retirement age, you get an 8% increase in that monthly payment. So if you were to get a $1,000 payment now and you waited a year, you'd now get $1,080 a year later. But you'll be missing out on 12 months worth of checks, $12,000 in our case here. So you really don't get an 8% increase. There are a lot of different variables which can affect the actual rate of return you get by waiting, but usually it's about 3 to 4%. So if you think you can make more than 3 to 4% on your own money investing it, then it's probably a good idea to wait. But if you think you can't do that well, you might want to take it. And regardless of when you do choose to take Social Security, usually you have to live to 80 to make waiting worth it, to make it so you break even.
If Beth does take her Social Security, do you have any guidance for what to do with it?
It's going to be taxable. Social Security in and of itself is not taxable, but there's a formula that the IRS requires us to use where we take half of our Social Security payments in retirement and then add all of our other income, including such strange sources as tax-free municipal bond interest. And then over certain thresholds, Social Security then can become taxable. So she may want to bump up her contributions to a pre-tax retirement plan like an IRA or a 401k or a 403b, whatever plan she qualifies for. She still gets the money then from Social Security, but by sliding it in to that pre-tax plan, it can avoid taxation, and she will reduce her taxation on that particular income in that year and then likely pay a lower tax rate once she retires. However, she should be very careful because if she plans on using it soon in retirement, she has a very short time frame. And when you have a short time frame to invest, you probably want to be more conservative with it because if she does experience a big loss on investing that money, it'll wipe out any tax advantage she might otherwise get.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. What personal finance questions do you have for Kevin during this On Your Money? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us your question at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Perry in Milwaukee. Go ahead, Perry.
Good morning, Kate and Kevin. Kevin, I go back to your Sunday morning show, and I got to say, after all this time, you don't look any different on the radio than you did back then.
Thank you. I'm a lot of collagen, and a team of plastic surgeon experts keep me well-preserved.
There you go. Kevin, my question is regarding donor-advised funds. I'm retired now for a couple of years. My wife will be retiring next June, and we're looking to increase charitable giving. And I was wondering what your opinion was, if you had one, on donor-advised funds, and if you were aware of any places I could go, either books in the library or websites that might rate the various funds that are available for that type of thing.
Yeah, well, my opinion is I really like them. I've used them in my grown-up job as a financial planner for several clients, and the clients are really happy with them. Here's how a donor advised fund works. You make a contribution of cash or appreciated assets. The reason you might use appreciated assets is because when you give, let's say you bought a stock at $10 a share, and now it's worth $20 a share, when you give that stock to the donor advised fund, you don't pay any taxes on the gain that you've made, but you get a tax deduction on the donation. And then once you put the money or the securities into the donor advised fund, it's sold, and it can be reinvested in a kind of a narrow pool usually of investments, kind of like you usually have in your 401k. You get a tax break when you make the donation. You do not necessarily have to donate that money then to a charity right away. You can spread it out over time. So if this is a year in which you think you and your wife are going to be taxed more highly than you will be in future years, you might want to make the donation to the donor advised fund now. And then let's say you're going to give, you look at your situation and say, well, we usually give $1,000 a year. And so for the next 10 years, we're going to put our $10,000 in the donor advised fund now, get a big tax break, and then maybe give $1,000 a year directly from the donor advised fund. The donor advised fund is usually run by, can be run by firms like Schwab and Fidelity or Vanguard. Many communities have their own donor advised fund, and some charities have their own donor advised fund as well. And the money has to go to a qualified 501c3 organization. And the reason they call it donor advised is you get to say when, how much, and to whom you want to donate it. But it has to be approved by the people running the donor advised fund just to make sure it's a qualified organization. Now, in terms of hunting these things out, there aren't any resources that I know of where you can weigh all the donor advised funds against each other. And in fact, many of them, especially the ones offered by larger financial services firms, they've kind of become commodities, meaning that they're fairly similar to each other. The funds are fairly similar. The expenses are fairly similar. You might already have a relationship with a firm who has a donor advised fund, and you might say, well, I like working with these people, so I'm just going to have them set it up for me. But you can have as many different donor advised funds as you want, and they're can be opened up for as little. I think some of them have a minimum as low as $5,000 to set up. So I think it's a really great deal, especially for people who, like it sounds like in your situation, are in a high tax bracket now and are likely to be in a lower tax bracket down the road when you make future donations.
Well, Perry, thanks so much for your question. Let's now go to Jack in Prairie du Chien. Go ahead, Jack.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I have an enthusiastic driver right now.
And Jack, you're cutting out. And yeah. Wait, try it one more time here.
Okay, I have a question. Which is better, consumer private loan or home equity loan? And where can I get advice about each? And I could probably take my answer off the air because I'm going into a vest.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Kate.
Jack is a student wondering okay. if a personal loan or a home equity loan is better. Which is better?
Well, it depends on for what you're borrowing it. If you're a student, you should actually get student loans, and you should start by filling out the FAFSA report, and you can actually start now.
October 1st.
Good for you. You've done your homework. The October 1st, you can start filling out the FAFSA for the fall semester of 2018. And you should fill out the FAFSA regardless of your situation, because you never know what financial aid for which you might qualify. But most people will qualify for some form of some subsidized or unsubsidized federal loans. And those are easier to get. They have a lower interest rate than most other types of borrowing. And the great thing about it, Jack, is that if you start there, you still have the opportunity to borrow against your home equity line of credit or get a personal loan to cover any other financial emergencies that you might have. But it's very difficult to go back and say, December 19th of 2018, oh, shoot, I need some money, and then fill out the FAFSA and then try to get the student loans that way. It's much easier to get the loans now. So start there. Otherwise, I'd rather have you get a personal loan and then, again, save the home equity loan or home equity line of credit for other bigger needs. You can only borrow money to go to school. Those other kinds of loans you can use for just about any purpose you want, as long as you can get approval.
Well, Jack, thanks for the call, and good luck there with your studies. Mike has a question, Kevin. He has an IRA with an insurance company that has a fixed-rate annuity component to it that pays 4.5%. He says, I haven't used it yet. All money is in variable account. There isn't any limit to the number of times that I can move in or money out of it. I'm being told these types of deals aren't even available anymore. My dilemma, Mike says, is that I'm going to be working with a financial advisor, and that financial advisor wants me to transfer my money out of the current IRA and into one that he will manage. My insurance agent is telling me that I'm crazy for giving up the availability of the 4.5% annuity. What do you think?
Well, I don't think crazy is an appropriate term here. I think the more correct term is mentally ill. The issue is not that there's crazy or not, but whether it's a good decision. And I think that in this particular case, 4.5% is a really good rate for these kinds of investments. Now, insurance agents and insurance companies like to talk about how safe these investments are. They're not as safe as they are portrayed. They're still very safe. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being a certificate of deposit, these are about an 8, or 7.5 or 8. And to give you an idea of how valuable 4.5% is, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is right around 22,000 right now. To get a 4.5% increase on that, that's 1,000 points. So there could be other drawbacks and costs to this particular account, but it sounds pretty good, and it's impossible to duplicate this elsewhere. If the listener takes that money and says, I'm going to go somewhere else and try to find 4.5% on it with new money, I don't even know where he would start, because it's impossible to find that kind of investment in a new account.
So how could Mike still work with the advisor if he doesn't transfer money from the account?
Well, he has a few options. Hopefully he has some other assets that the advisor can manage and then use it in kind of a complementary fashion with the money that he's keeping in this other account. And maybe he can keep a portion of this account. Let's say if he's got $200,000 to invest and maybe $100,000 of it in that 4.5% account, maybe he can still leave at least $50,000 or something, for example, in that particular account. And it's a fair question to ask the advisor and say, you know, I'm hearing that this is a really good investment. I don't want to give it up just to work with you. Are there other options where I can keep some or all of the money in that account and still work together?
And if none of these solutions work?
It's a tough point to be in. I would actually suggest you look for other advisors, because, you know, there's no, me included, there's no advisor out there who has all the answers or is perfect for an individual. And so you might want to look for one who has lower minimums, who can invest the money that Mike might have left over, or you can see if the current advisor will work with Mike on an hourly basis rather than on a fee, because part of the reason he probably wants to bring that money in is because he might have some minimums he has to meet to work together, or, you know, he wants to make more money from charging on the fees. But that's not a good enough reason to transfer it from one place to another if it's already in a good place.
And you're listening to On Your Money with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Join in with your money question, 800-642-1234. You can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back after a short break. Maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. It is On Your Money with financial planner Kevin McKinley. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show. Kevin is taking your money questions. Ask away at 800-642-1234. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. So, Kevin, Bob says, we've traditionally given each of our daughter and our son-in-law $5,500 for Christmas presents to be placed in their Roth IRAs, but now have new jobs and are contributing to their employer's Roth 401ks. Their combined income is about $100,000. Can we and they still contribute to their Roth now that they have Roth 401ks at work?
Yes. Let's start with can they. They can contribute to the account. There are, as long as they meet the income limitations for a married couple filing jointly, it's $186,000 to $196,000 for the 2017 tax year of adjusted gross income. But if they make $100,000, yes, they can contribute to both Roth 401ks and the Roth IRAs.
But should they?
Yes to the Roth IRA, but in my opinion, no to the Roth 401k. Their income is likely to be above, at least part of it, above the 15% federal income tax bracket, and therefore will be taxed at 25%. So they're better off taking at least a portion of their income and putting it into the pre-tax 401k, because they will save probably around 25 cents for every dollar that they put into that 401k. And again, tax rates are usually lower in retirement than they are while we're working.
And how so?
The income will likely be less because people usually just have less income in retirement. But also their spending will likely be less. They won't have to support kids maybe, or they'll have their mortgage paid off. They're just able to live on less. Social Security is, as we've mentioned, technically tax-free, and at the worst case scenario, still going to be taxed less than actual income from other sources. And most importantly, people in retirement can pick and choose how they pull their income out of their various sources. And that manipulation and ability to manipulate the income means that they can say, okay, I need X amount of dollars. Here are all the sources I have. How am I going to pull it out and still keep it below a certain tax amount? And we don't have that opportunity with most employers. We can't say to our boss, hey, I know you were going to pay me $50,000, but pay me $25,000 this year and $75,000 next year, because I'll save taxes that way.
Let's take another call now. Mike in southeastern Wisconsin. Go ahead, Mike.
Kevin, I got a question on suspended passive losses. Do you think that with the potential tax reform coming up, that those suspended losses for real, you know, rental property that's sold, are they still going to be able to be deducted? Or do you think that'll, when Trump's talking about doing taxes on a postcard, it kind of concerns me for some of my rental property?
Well, one of the things you have to remember, Mike, is this is all just talk. And technically, one of the reasons we don't address a lot of, you know, this person put this bill together, this politician said this, is that it's a long way from somebody spouting some ideas or platitudes and then actually having it become a law. And so you do have to take it into effect in your planning and say there's always going to be some uncertainty in tax planning. But you also have to remember who you're dealing with here. I mean, if there's one person that real estate write-offs are going to benefit, it's probably Donald Trump. And so if he acts on his own best interest, he's probably unlikely to be a big fan of moving that off. That said, one of the The reasons behind so-called tax reform is they're trying to simplify it, and there's a possibility we could lose deductions that we otherwise cherished. I've even heard talk of saying that they're going to stop allowing pre-tax 401ks. They're calling it the Rothification of retirement saving, meaning that you don't get any deductions on any savings, but everything you pull out is tax-free in retirement. Again, this is just speculation and a bunch of people talking. Do not pay too much attention to it until it actually gets close to becoming a law. But again, you may want to just hold on to some of the trepidation you have and keep it in mind as you're proceeding throughout the rest of this year.
Mike, thanks so much for the call. Let's now go to Lynn in La Crosse. Go ahead, Lynn.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call and welcome, Kate. I have a question about the Equifax issue. And as far as putting a lock or a freeze on my credit bureaus, what's the difference between the lock and the freeze? And I understand there might be some costs involved, but I don't want it to be ongoing costs. And then when I take the lock or freeze off, if I do need to borrow, and I'm not anticipating that I do in the near future, is there a cost to take that off? But mainly, what's the difference between the cost and the freeze, and do you recommend one or the other?
Right. It depends on the different bureau, and these bureaus are now changing their terms all the time because of the Equifax hack and because people are paying a lot more attention to this now than they have before. A credit lock is something that the bureaus are pushing. I don't like it as much just because it doesn't keep things quite as tight. It still allows some access to your account that the bureaus don't like, but you may actually prefer. I'd much rather have you pay for the freeze. And when you have the freeze, that means nobody who doesn't have a previous relationship with you, meaning your current bank or credit provider, no one can go into your credit report and get information to offer you services, but also to open up a credit card account in your name. And that's why the freeze is more important. It's a bigger hassle than the lock, but I would rather have you get the freeze instead and pay for it. We're going to be talking about this in a few weeks. We're going to have another segment devoted to the Equifax hack. I think we'll probably be talking about this for a very long time off and on, so stay tuned.
Well, Lynn, good luck, and thank you so much for calling in on this All Questions Asked and Answered, hopefully, segment of On Your Money. Let's go to Barbara now in Milwaukee. Go ahead, Barbara.
I don't have any false praise because it's all true. I love the show, and I've learned a lot listening.
Thank you, Barbara.
You're welcome. Thank you. I have a small pension from a retailer that did go through bankruptcy reorganization in the 90s, has been losing market share. Store closings have been proceeding over the past years. I've been offered a pension buyout. It's a small pension, and they are offering a lump sum versus a monthly now pension, which is actually higher than the monthly pension if I would take it later. The lump sum is equivalent to about 11 years of the monthly now payment. But the pension fund, there are articles out there saying the pension fund is underfunded
Yep.
by the retailer. And I need to, if I take the lump sum payment, it's quite a bit less. I would typically take the monthly now, but given the precarious nature of this retailer, if they would close, if they would, how do I know whether that pension would still exist if I were to take the monthly pension?
That's a great question, Barbara, and it's an eternal one that pension recipients and beneficiaries struggle with, is do I take my bird in the hand or do I take the two in the bush? And for most people, in my experience, they tend to look at the dilemma you're facing and say, I want my money now, even though it's going to be less, because once I have it in my hand, they can't take it away from me. You have to remember, when a company is struggling, and more importantly, their pension is struggling now, we've had almost going on a 9-year run of increases in stock prices, other kinds of asset prices, and increases in the economy. And if a retailer and a pension are struggling right now, Imagine how bad they're going to do when things get worse in the economy. And they always would do. It's going to happen sooner or later. It might start happening this afternoon. It might not happen for 5 years, but it will. Things do decline in value, and the economy gets worse. It's the natural cycle of things. And so it's very tempting to take that monthly check because then, you know, it's going to be greater than what that lump sum can probably provide you as an investment. But that indeed is the problem, because how can they manage it and give you much more than you can get off on an investment? And the fact is they can't. That's part of the reason the pension is struggling, is because they've overpromised for what they're able to deliver. And when a pension comes up short, usually if it's a private company, the private company has to make up the difference. If the private company's not doing well, then the pension goes to the pension benefit and guarantee insurance organization. That's kind of a quasi-government function that tends to step in for pensions that can't support themselves. But a lot of these pensions are going to be going bad at the same time, and then there's a big question as to who will be on the hook for the pension. So I'm a bird in the hand kind of guy, Barbara, so I would prefer that you take that. But if you have other assets that you have that you can live off of, if something happens to your pension check, you may want to roll the dice and see if both you and the pension make it at least 11 years so that you beat the odds.
Barbara, good luck with that decision. Kevin, we've got an email from Tyler. Tyler says, Kevin and Kate, thanks for all your wonderful shows. That's more Kevin than me. But over the years, I've been living with my father, Tyler says, now after high school for 8 years, graduated college recently. Congrats. I've got a decent job now, making about $55,000 a year. I'm currently a contractor, so I'm not certain my current job is permanent, and I don't have savings really. But I am confident I can keep getting jobs if I lose this one. I also have about $20,000 in student loan debt. Is it realistic to try to find a permanent place to live at this point, or should I just rent for now? I expect my income to significantly increase once I leave the contractor phase of my life.
Well, good for you, Tyler. You've done very well for yourself. And if you don't have any savings, it's probably not a good time to be buying a home, in part because the bank is going to ask you to have some form of down payment. It doesn't have to be 20%, especially for some first-time home buyers, but the bank and the lender are going to want you to have some down payment. And you're a perfect candidate to rent if you want to move out of your folks' place. Rent for a year and see how that goes. There are a lot of people right now who are in Tyler's position who are going to rent maybe for most of their lives. You know, America is unique in its rate of home ownership, and many other intelligent people over the world just like renting, and they rent for their whole lives, and they get along perfectly fine. They like the lack of capital tied up in what can be a very expensive asset. They like the flexibility to go when and where they want to without having to sell a house. And so there's nothing wrong with renting. I would have you rent for at least a year or two before you can build up 6 months worth of your living expenses, and also at least 10% and hopefully 20% of the cost of a home purchase. You may not have to put that much down, Tyler, but it is good to have that amount of money set aside so that if you do lose your job, whether it's a contractor or doing something else, you can pull from that savings to make your mortgage payment so that you don't get foreclosed upon or have to sell the house in a hurry.
Well, Tyler, thank you so much for your email at onyourmoney@wpr.org. Angela in Birchwood has been waiting with her question. Angela, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you again for taking my call. I have actually three questions. The first one pertains to your views regarding loans tied to interest only. We're finishing one of those up. It's actually tied to the LIBOR rate. And I'm wondering in general what the general risks or benefits are to loans that are tied to the LIBOR rate. You know, when the Feds increase interest rates, for example, can one reliably predict what's going to happen to the LIBOR rate? My second question is, it seems that banks are starting to get into the space where investment houses have been living in terms of trying to get a greater scope of managing your money, and it seems like that would have some inherent conflicts, but I guess I'd be interested in your thoughts. And the third, my husband and I have this ongoing discussion about going with Janus or Vanguard funds that are lower cost in terms of trades or keeping versus paying on average what is perhaps a 1% fee to an investment house to do that type of work. So those are my questions for you.
That's it? No more questions other than that? First of all, let's address the question about the rates. Rates aren't likely to go up, and even if the Federal Reserve does actually raise interest rates, they won't raise them dramatically. And the LIBOR rate is not completely tied to the Fed, but it is also it parallels it. And so you may see rates go up somewhat, but I don't think it'll happen. And in fact, the way the economy has been going, you might see rates actually stay flat or even go down. In terms of banks getting into the investment business, yes, that's been going on for decades, and it will continue to go through. There's just when larger financial entities exhaust all of their opportunities to make a buck, they start looking at other places to do it. And sometimes laws prevent them from moving into other areas, but not when it comes to investments. And then finally, when it comes to whether you should pay someone to do it yourself, I do believe I'm a big fan of very low-cost funds like the Vanguard funds and many other others out there now are very low-cost funds. And the question comes of paying someone else to do it. It's no different, for lack of a better phrase, than paying someone to mow your lawn. If you like it and you enjoy doing it, do it yourself. And there has never been a better time in history for a do-it-yourself investor to get all the information and access to accounts that she needs. But if you say, I don't enjoy doing this and I'd rather pay someone else to do it, the paying someone on a fee basis is, in my opinion, a fair way to work with them rather than a commission basis, because you're only paying them while you're happy with the service. And if at any reason you're not happy with the service and the advice that they're providing, you terminate the relationship and you don't pay them anymore. And that gives them an incentive to keep you happy, because otherwise they lose you as a customer or a client. And it gives you the freedom and some leverage to make sure you're getting all that you need out of the relationship. And the best way to find out is to try it. And if you don't like it, you can always cancel it and you can take it over yourself or transfer it to somebody else.
Well, Angela, Kevin answered your questions at breakneck speed. So thank you so much for calling in. And John in Burlington, you've been waiting. John, go ahead.
Good morning. I have a quick question for you. My daughter just finished college in spring. She has her first job. She can stay on our health insurance for 3.5 years. She needs a car, a reliable car, wondering what the best plan of attack would be to accomplish that. Is it lease? Is it try to buy a car in that 3 or 4 year window, and finance it, and, because her income will decrease significantly once she obviously has to start paying for health insurance.
Right. Yeah. What I would do is can she, do you know if she has good enough credit now where she can get a lease or a loan for a car?
I'm not sure. I mean, we're looking, but we haven't gone in and applied or anything like that yet.
Okay. And I'm sorry, John, does she have a job now?
She does. She does.
Okay.
She's a teacher. So.
Oh, great. Well, the good news is that at least for now, they're still giving out car loans basically, based on people who have a pulse and can fog a mirror. And it's not as easy as it once was, but it's still pretty easy for it. So I would have her go to a credit union or your local bank and talk with them first and say, what kind of car loan could I qualify for? What would the interest rate be? And you're right to be concerned about the cost of her health insurance. And in an ideal situation, what I would suggest is she actually get a new car. And it sounds crazy and extravagant for a young person to get a new car. But the nice thing about the new car is that, first of all, her expenses are going to be fixed. If she doesn't have a lot of extra savings and you either are unable or are not interested in paying for her car repairs, she's less likely to have some kind of breakdown with a brand new car. And if she does, it should be covered under the warranty, at least for the first few years. So I'd actually rather have her purchase a new car. And then 3 or 4 years from now, if indeed she does have a big boost in expenses that come from the higher health insurance costs, she'll hopefully have an almost paid for car that'll still be in pretty good shape. The median age of cars on the road right now, John, is almost 12 years. And so even if she drives that car for until, let's see, the year 2029, at that point, she'd still be in the upper half of age of cars on the road. And I'll just say that I think she should get a new car. I think it should be something sensible. I think it should be something that will hopefully last her. You know, you want something very basic, like if she wants a sedan or something, you want like a Honda Accord or something that's pretty straightforward and has a lot of good use to it. Or if she thinks she might be having kids in the next 3 to 5 years, she might also want to look at like a some kind of smaller SUV, like the Toyota RAV4, Honda CRV. Subarus are also a very popular vehicle that are relatively low cost and really have great safety ratings and do last a long time.
Well, John, good luck with the car shopping. And with the change of seasons, does it motivate you to make changes to your financial well-being? Are you planning to eat out less, perhaps? Or take a look at your smartphone bill right now and your paid subscriptions. What is it that's on your mind about your hard-earned dollars? Ask away, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Back with your money questions for financial planner Kevin McKinley after this short break here on the Ideas Network. It's On Your Money here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent here with Kevin McKinley. He's our go-to financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. All that's missing is you. Join in the conversation about your money at 800-642-1234. Send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And let's hear, we have a question from Stacy, who says, we're looking at fixing a basement water problem along with updating the finished part of the basement. The loan may be anywhere between $10,000 to $20,000. We currently have $20,000 in a regular savings account and another $35,000 in a Vanguard index fund. Would it be better, Stacy wonders, to use the money we have in our regular savings account or index fund instead of the loan? We have been averaging around $20,000 in the savings account, and I use that money for our annual property taxes, about $5,000, which we don't escrow. I have a steady income, but my husband does not.
Well, I am all for the remodeling, especially with the water problem in the basement. It's not if that will need to be fixed, it's when. And the rest of it, in finishing part of it, you know, it increases the value of the home, usually not 100%. You don't get a dollar-for-dollar return in appreciation, but it does increase the value of the home somewhat. And whatever that difference is between the cost of the improvement and the actual increase in value, look upon it as cost for enjoyment of the home. And the longer you live there, the lower that cost per day of use is going to be.
But what about paying for it?
Well, a couple of factors stand out. The cost is a significant portion of their savings, and with only one source of steady income in the couple, there's always a question of whether or not you're going to have any income, especially if Stacy, something happens to her job and her paycheck. Therefore, it's better to pay for this out of the home equity loan. Yes, you're going to have a guaranteed interest cost for it, but you are going to have some flexibility in terms of paying it off. A 10-year loan for $20,000 at 5% probably going to cost Stacy and her husband about $200 per month. And if they just get completely healthy and wealthy financially and they say, we have more money than we know what to do with it, they can always pay that loan off, and usually there's no prepayment penalty to do so.
But what if they instead decide to use their savings and investments to pay for the remodeling?
Well, I would like them to take at least part of that from the stock fund, if not all of it, because you know, the stock fund generally has a greater chance for long-term rates of return, higher rates of return, but it also, of course, has more risk. And there's a danger that they could, if they pulled it out of their savings, then they have all of their money at risk, and that could cut in half in a very bad year, and they wouldn't want to happen that. If they do use some from their savings and at least some from the stock fund, I'd also want them to, though, open up a home equity line of credit. And what that allows them to do is then tap that home equity line of credit in an emergency. So, yes, they have the basement remodeling paid for, but they can draw from the home equity line of credit to cover expenses if something else comes up. And then, again, they don't have enough income coming in.
Let's take another call now. Christina in Glenwood. Go ahead, Christina. Hello.
Oh, happy day. Thank you, Well, my home is about 20 years old. My mortgage rate is 5.5. And I'm wondering, is this a good time to refinance at 30 years? And if so, how much should I borrow and what fees should I expect to pay to make it worthwhile? I'm thinking in terms of having cash on hand for future home improvements.
Christina, great question. Are these improvements something that you're sure you're going to do, or is it something you think you might want to do, or you just want to have it there just in case?
Well, the possibility is, say, if a furnace were to go out, something like that.
Got it. Okay. Well, I think it is a great idea to refinance. The question is that if it will make sense to you to refinance, you could probably get the interest rate down around 4%, depending on your situation. The closing cost should be somewhere in the range of $2,000 to $4,000. Anything over that, you probably need to shop around for another lender, or it doesn't make sense to borrow money at this particular time. But once you get it down, you're going to have lower payment. You're going to free up some cash. And I would kind of jot down everything you think will need to be done to the house. And you may even want to start doing it now. If something is really wrong, or you think it's going to need to be replaced or needs to be updated, go ahead and use the proceeds from the mortgage to do it. But otherwise, a better way to go about it is to refinance what you can finance. And then again, open up a home equity line of credit, because then you can tap that in the future if you want and you need it for remodeling or any other kind of emergency, but you don't have to apply for the loan at that particular time. Now, the only downside to the home equity line of credit is, the good news is, you only pay interest on what you borrow, but that interest rate, Christina, floats. It can rise and fall with interest rates. Whereas if you refinance now into a new 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, your rate is now locked in. It can't go any higher. And if it's ever advantageous for you to pay off that fixed-rate loan, you can go ahead and do so, usually with little or no penalty. But if you look at this and you decide, well, I'm only going to take a certain amount out just to refinance what I already owe, then get a home equity line of credit for the difference and use that to pay for any future furnace malfunctions.
Well, Christina, happy day back at you, and good luck. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Sue in Milwaukee. Go ahead, Sue.
Good morning. I love your show. I'm calling because my husband and I would like to retire in about 6 years. Problem is that our mortgage will not be paid off for about 9 years. So my question is, are we better off escalating payments to the mortgage or saving more for retirement so that we can then continue to pay a mortgage for the first few years that we're retired?
Sue, do you think you and your husband right now will have a gross income combined of over $100,000?
In retirement or
today?
No,
while you're working.
Yes.
Okay. If you do, then it's probably more advantageous to save, to maximize your savings into pre-tax plans like IRAs, 403Bs, and 401Ks, because you're going to save about at least 25 cents or so in federal taxes for every dollar that you set aside in that, over and above, say, about $100,000. And then when you pull that out, you're likely to only pay about 15% taxes on it. So you're going to have about a 10% spread between at least what you save in taxes versus what you pay on it. So if it's that short of a time, there's usually automatically a 1% to 2% advantage for it. And since you can pay the mortgage off whenever you want, and you probably have a relatively low interest rate on that mortgage right now, right?
0.45.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's fantastic. I'd say, yeah, I'd rather have you bump up your retirement savings. Now, keep in mind, as we've mentioned previously in this show and all the other 600 shows we've done, when you put money aside in for retirement savings, if you put it in stock market-based mutual funds or even bond funds for that matter, there is some risk involved with this. And so there's a danger that, yes, you'll get a tax break on the savings when you put it in there, but you could have a loss that would more than offset the tax break. So you have to be very cautious about that. But I just like the flexibility of having the mortgage and the money, even though the interest does cost it, and your mortgage payment is only going to last for a few years into your retirement. As long as you don't have to pull extra money out of your tax deferred accounts that then boost you up into the higher tax bracket, I'd rather have you just pay it off as slowly as possible. And if you get into retirement and the tax laws allow you to get at a bunch of your money at a favorable rate, then you can go ahead and just pay the whole thing off and be done with it.
Sue, thanks so much for the call. We have time for just one more call, Kevin. Let's go to Elizabeth in Madison. Go ahead, Elizabeth, quickly.
Hi, yes. I have a 401k through Van, or I'm sorry, I have a Roth IRA through Vanguard that I've been contributing to personally, and I just started a new job, and they're offering kind of a Roth, I guess, 401k with the exact same Vanguard fund, and I'm wondering if I should just stop contributing to my personal Roth and just put all of that in with the employer fund because they're doing it pre-tax, I guess.
Okay, if it's pre-tax, here's what I would do. Is Elizabeth, I would whatever dollar amount of income you have, are you a single filer or married filing jointly?
I'm a married.
You're married. Okay. For whatever dollars you have that of income that are over about $100,000 of gross, that should probably go into the pre-tax option that you have at work.
Okay.
And then anything below that, you can keep contributing to your own personal Roth IRA if you still have the money to do it. And it's because the tax savings are so high by going into that pre-tax plan. The nice thing about using your own Roth IRA is that you can pull the contributions to that account back out whenever you want, at any time, for any reason, with no penalties or taxes whatsoever. So all that money you put into that Roth, that's really an emergency fund for you. And when you get to retirement, if you haven't used any of that money, you can pull it out tax-free after the age of 59 and a half. But it's a nice balance between the pre-tax savings that you have accumulated and the Roth IRA as well, which will be tax-free. So again, contribute enough to at least get yourself down into the 15% federal income tax bracket, and that's about anything below $100,000 of gross income, give or take, for married couples filing jointly, and $50,000 for single filers.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much, and good luck to you. We appreciate your call. Kevin, it's now time for the website of the week. What do we got?
Well, this is an all questions answered show, Kate, and Jeff emailed us a while ago, and he said, I'm a longtime listener. And it sounds like he's admitting that rather than bragging about it. On many of your shows, you often say you will post a link or some other information on your website. I've looked for this information many, many times, and I've never found it. Where is it hidden? Well, it's not hidden. It's just not quite as clear as it probably should be. The website is onyourmoney.com. And every time we do a show like we're doing right now, we put a link up to that show at our website, onyourmoney.com, usually under the headline that says this week's show or the most recent show. And in that, we talk about what, in this case, you and I have talked about today, Kate. Plus, there's a link to the WPR.org website where you can click on it, download it, broadcast it directly. And then that's where we also put the websites of the week. But to answer this question and a few other people who have asked, we are going to put in a special section at onyourmoney.com that will have all the websites that we have, the FEMA kit for organizing your finances, the Equifax site for deciding if you need a credit freeze, the site you can use to make money while traveling or make money while pet sitting, and the salary comparison site are all websites that people have contacted us and said, hey, I'd like to find that. Where is it? Well, we'll have a special section up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And people make a lot of use out of those related links so they can do their research. Is that right, Kevin?
That is correct.
And we have four more words before we go. What are they?
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, and he's managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard live every Tuesday morning at 8 on the Ideas Network. It's rebroadcast Saturdays at noon here on the Ideas Network. This hour was produced by Brianne Chasseau. We had technical direction from executive producer Michelle Johnson. And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the morning show on the Ideas Network. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.